our high watermark, or the high watermark of my career as publisher of Harper's Magazine, was when George W. Bush was president. And we were the leader of the opposition. We were way ahead of the New Yorker. The New Yorker, if you'll recall, endorsed the invasion of Iraq, and all the liberal media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera. We alone, with maybe the nation, opposed the invasion of Iraq. And from that point on, we were off like a rocket. And our newsstand sales were the highest they've ever been. And subscriptions were pouring in. And people were reading it on the subway numbers that I'd never seen before. So with the election of Trump, which of course is a horror, we're seeing a huge spike in subscriptions. And we're already organized around this principle, this notion of being the leading opposition magazine. Because I can see that already certain media are trying to accommodate themselves, look on the bright side, and so on and so forth. We won't accommodate ourselves, and we will be leaders. And it'll start with the January issue. I can't tell you what's on the cover, but I think it'll surprise you, and I hope delight you.
Yeah, well, I think the effect you're talking about has already been, I think the New York Times is feeling the positive effects
right.
of that, because how many new digital subscribers?
Well, I don't know, but they've got the same rate as us, about four times the usual. And it was Trump that forced them to put it in the paper. The Times is getting a little bit more courageous because they're so consistently abused and insulted by Trump, they have to respond. And they finally actually said, that's not true in a story. We're not going out of business. We're selling four times as many subscriptions as usual. So that's the most optimistic thing I can say.
Okay, so let's switch gears for a second and talk about the opposite polarity, which would be, I mean, what keeps you guys up at night? What are you worried about? What kind of gnaws away at you these days and affects your sleep?
Me first?
It doesn't matter.
You
had
a pretty good summation of it to begin with. Just the question of how rapidly print revenue has declined in our business. We knew that we were facing kind of gradual secular decline, several years ago. But the past couple of years in particular has the speed of decline in print revenue has accelerated to the point where it's worrying. It worries you about the ability to sustain high-quality journalism.
Okay. My magazine, we're fortunate not to have to worry as much about the bottom line as some other publications, just because our funding source is more varied. But in general, I worry about the erosion in authority in our society. Harper's, Rogers, Toronto Life, The Walrus, any of the big brands are built on the idea that professionally curated, edited, and presented content is going to be better than fake news stories from Macedonia about how Hillary Clinton killed Vince Foster. But there seems to be this sort of leveling of information, which takes place thanks to Facebook, thanks to Twitter, and thanks to, unfortunately, the professionalization of fake news. I used to write a lot about conspiracy theories 5 years ago, and one of the hallmarks of a conspiracy theorist's website is that it looked amateurish. It looked like a Yahoo GeoCities site, if anybody in the room was old enough to remember that. Yep. But now, any 17-year-old can make a super professional-looking site that has fake news on it. And so optically, there is just this complete leveling of the presentation of expertly edited and authored news and analysis and complete fake stuff that's just there for the hits. And I am worried about that leveling process because it takes away from the main advantage that I think the publications represented on this podium have, which is authority, expertise, and artful creation.
Gotcha.
Well, in media in 2016, it's hard to even enumerate the things to be worried about. The magazine just celebrated its 50th anniversary. I hope we make it to 51. I hope not to be the last editor of Toronto Life. I worry about, we've become on our staff stupendously good at cost cutting. That's not something you really want to be great at. I worry about talent retention. I worry about salary freezes. I worry about salary cuts. I worry about great people not wanting to be journalists. I worry about, I mean, this could go on all night. I worry about, you know, not paying our creative people, our writers and our photographers as well as they deserve to be paid, and the staff. I mean, that literally, that is the thing that keeps me up at night.
Is it still a good career for people, do you think, Sarah? What if your kids said, Mommy, Mommy, I want to be a journalist? What would you say?
I'm like the fourth in a line of journalists, so it's sort of destined that at least one of my kids will end up a journalist. So I suspect I won't have much say in any of that. I don't know. I mean, I it's very hard to say. I think people who do things, I mean, what is a good career? There is tremendous meaning and purpose to be found in our work. We've had one of our best feature editors left to go work at a startup, and he's gonna have a much more lucrative career. So that may be one measure of what is a good career. It's I think you'd have to ask the really interesting 21-year-olds that call me up every day wanting to have coffee to find out how to get into the business why they are opting for that career.
Yeah.
I have so many negative things to say that I don't want to overdo it at the outset. So I'll start with a funny one, a funny negative thing. I thought I had won the argument about paywalls. I've been ridiculing the idea of free journalism and free content since the late 90s, early 2000s. Doesn't mean we're not suffering at Harper's. Believe me, we're suffering like everybody else. But we never bought into the idea that information should be free. Should food be free? Farmers aren't as stupid as most publishers. So, but that's the way people were talking. But then I'm not absolutely persuaded that I've won the argument, because I've currently got a guy named Charlie Glass, very talented journalist in his late 60s, I guess now, over in Iraq covering Mosul, the fight for Mosul, with Don McCullen, who's 80, the great Vietnam era war photographer. And it cost us a lot of money to get him over there, even with the discounted fares from Beirut to Erbil and so on and so forth. I mean, not a lot of people are trying to take those planes, so it's not that expensive. Charlie sent me this just before he left for Mosul to meet up with Don, and he says he got a letter from a guy who started another startup. It's a literary review based in London, and I'll cut to the chase. The editor says, "I was wondering if you might be interested in contributing the occasional review sometime. We are regrettably unable to pay our contributors. The site is entirely volunteer run and generates no advertising revenue. But we can offer free review copies of books by way of inducement, and we're very flexible about deadlines. I look forward to hearing from you." So Charlie writes back, I'm not going to say his name, I don't want to embarrass him. "Dear so-and-so, thank you very much for writing. I am thinking of establishing a construction company which will build some interesting and original structures. I wonder whether you would consider donating your time as a day laborer. While we would not pay you, we would certainly be pleased to have you on board. Yours sincerely, Charlie Glass." I mean, you'd think at this point, every self-respecting person who is interested in writing, because writing is work, and every publisher would realize that this is a dead end. This game cannot go on any longer. And so when I talk about digital correctness, that's what keeps me up at night. The idea that this lemming-like mentality that developed 15, 16 years ago during the first big boom, which blew up in the bubble popped in 2001, was it?
2001.
You'd think by now people would have learned that this is not going to work. There's got to be some other alternative. And yet I pick up the Financial Times, my favorite paywalled newspaper, And I read a piece by Douglas Copeland, and I, you know, he's a well-known writer, and he says, he's writing about the wonders of the internet. He says, when I discuss the internet's feel and its random rodeo of fonts, I think of the freedom, naivete, laziness, greed, cluelessness, and skill I see there. It's a cyber place as wondrous as the bubbling cradle of pea soup goo from which life emerged. I mean, this is gibberish. And it's gibberish at a very high level, though. And I've been hearing it now for 15 years from my colleagues in the business, the advertising and marketing people who have driven us down, and who disrespect utterly what we're trying to do. So I better stop there, because I have more to say later on the biz, because I want to talk about the hard business reality. I don't want to just talk in generalities about how terrible it is that writers are being screwed and publishers are going out of business.
That's kind of a perfect segue, okay. Because, and I'm not going to promise I'm going to keep going down the end.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
I'm here for free. I don't know if the other panelists are getting paid. I consider it a privilege to offer my opinion to people and other publications, and I often write for free, and I public speak for free. I think it's a great privilege to speak and have people hear and to write and have people read. And when publications can't offer money, I often will write for them. I've just finished writing a foreword for a book, and I won't receive a cent for that. That said, not everybody has the luxury of being able to do that,
right.
Which is why when I'm recruiting writers, and I do pay my writers, although as Sarah says, salaries have gone down and freelance rates have gone down in real terms. Yeah. So a dollar a word sounded great 20 or 30 years ago. A dollar a word doesn't buy nearly as much now. The people who can afford to be writers now, and this goes to the question of would you advise a young person to become a writer now, they often are trust fund children, or they are the sons and daughters of wealthy WASPs and Jews who are on their way to law school and are looking for 2 or 3 years of creative industry, before they go into the real work of an MBA or med school or law school or something like that. And it goes to the question of diversity to a certain extent, because for someone who's smart enough to do what is required to do in editorial work in magazines, a person who can do that usually is also smart enough to go to business school or to go to law school or dentistry or accounting or engineering. And it might make sense for them to still go to become an ink-stained wretch and make $35,000 or $40,000 a year because they want that creative buzz and because their family of doctors and accountants and engineers is encouraging to become fulfilled and follow their dreams. It makes much less sense if they're the sons and daughters of immigrants who have scrimped and saved and are having difficulty and came to Canada precisely so that their children could make a lot of money or at least have a secure life. So often we talk about these things as if they're siloed, the question of diversity and the question of salaries and economic security, but they're very much intermingled. And the economic model is becoming almost like the 19th century hobbyist, literary expert who, you know, he'll write for journals because he's a gentleman and he lives off the land and he can afford to do that. But the people who really have to earn a buck can't afford to do that. And so in a way, although we talk a lot about diversity, the economic model in our industry is driving diversity away because it's only the privileged who can afford to become writers and editors.
Does anyone want to respond to that or add to that?
I think that's exactly right. I couldn't agree with that more. I think it was, I mean, for me, I guess I look at it a little bit more optimistically in the sense that, you know, when young people say to me, you know, should I get into the business? I always tend to say, yeah, you absolutely should. It's incredibly interesting. And if you're really good at it, people are going to want to hear the stories that you have to tell. But it's going to be a struggle. And if you're up for the struggle for an interesting life, I think that there is a way and I believe that there will always be a way to carve out a sustainable life out of this, because I think that the whole instinct towards storytelling is actually really fundamental to human beings. So I think that we've got a natural drive to try and share our stories and to hear the stories of others. So I think there's always going to be a media business. We're at this awkward middle stage, I think, where we're transitioning from one economic model to a new one, and the new one isn't at all clear to us right now. But I guess I believe that there will be an economic model. And I think that when I see, you know, billions of dollars of capital flowing into new media companies all the time, I think that's the bet that a lot of people are making. Yeah. But it's sure hard, and it's not going to look anything like it did in the past.
I wouldn't bet on the trust fund brats either, to tell you the truth. The writers are the worst representatives you can think of for defending their own interests. They don't know how to do it. They're vain, egomaniacs. I'm one, I can tell you. But I'm also a publisher, so I have to handle writers a lot. And let me just describe a scene to you. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, at the Penn International gala dinner in New York, at the Natural History Museum on Central Park West, they decided, I'm a member of Penn, to honor the then chairman of Twitter. And there was this insane moment at this dinner where everybody in the room was holding up their phones, like primitive people discovering fire or something. It was absolutely bizarre. And Twitter, I think, you know, it's fair to say, is not the friend of literature. And you've got Salman Rushdie and Toni Morrison and all these people paying homage to Twitter and to the chairman of Twitter. And look at where Twitter's gotten us. I mean, it's the master of Twitter is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He's the greatest Twitterer of all time.
Yeah, but with all due respect.
So it's a catastrophe.
But Twitter,
it's not funny, actually.
If you're an obscure writer, Twitter is what you use to make your article go viral. Not everybody writes in Harper's. I mean, there are some people who write blogs.
Yeah, and you don't get paid a nickel for it.
Well,
so
they might.
What's the point?
But if you write, you want readers. And Twitter often will supply you with readers because it makes it known to the world.
Well, at some point, it's going to end. People cannot continue to write for nothing. Mm-hmm. It can't happen. And as you both said, the revenues are shrinking, and the ability of publishers to pay even a halfway reasonable fee is evaporating. So we're not to the nitty-gritty yet, though, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, so you've all sort of alluded to the business model and the realities of the business model, and you all have a fairly unique set of circumstances which govern your day-to-day activities and the way that you think about the industry. Steve, curious, after some of the changes, big changes that have happened at Rogers, and we've talked about this, there are a different set of pressures on you. So survival and profit are alone not enough. Mm-hmm. There needs to be growth. And clearly you don't feel like there's going to be growth given the sort of traditional business model that the Rogers magazines have always pursued.
Yeah, not in the way that we were constituted as recently as a year ago. There certainly wasn't going to be growth. We couldn't even reliably count on gentle decline. And you're right. So I run a publishing business within a very large telecom and communications publicly traded company, where, you know, generally the share price is, you know, priced on a tech company's multiple, and growth is what it's all about. It's not really about cash flow for us. It's not even really about margin. It's about what are your prospects to grow. That's what the market expects, so that's what management expects. And for me, the changes that we've gone through over the past year, pulling back from print, focusing more of our energy and resources on digital, because we know that we can grow the revenues there, not to the degree that we need to make up for the declines in print, at least not so far, but we can get to growth. And that's very much been the focus, particularly for us, because we're a tech and telecom company that very much believes in sharing stories and content as data, you know, on devices that you carry around in your pocket for the most part. So for us, it made perfect sense for us to focus our energies on trying to grow there. But it's not the same. It's not going to be the same model for everybody. I think one of the things that's interesting about this panel is you've got actually four very distinct circumstances, and it's going to be four very distinct strategies.
Yeah. So Sarah, I would say that you're somewhere between Steve and Rick on the spectrum of big versus small, foundation funded versus not, public versus private. What are some of the pressures that you're feeling at St. Joe's these days? What are people there talking? What are their expectations like?
Right. So Toronto Life Monthly, city magazine with a robust web content. The way, in terms of growth, I mean, I have this theory, and it's been proven by various experiments we've done at the magazine, that advertisers, and of course we are privately owned by one person who likes a profit, and we've always been advertiser supported. So no, the word foundation got me all excited, but unfortunately we have none. And so we have always been supported by advertisers, and we're still profitable, and we come out 12 times a year. I have this theory that advertisers will continue to want to play with us, providing our brand equity remains high, and that's my department. So, like, maintaining brand equity, that means making it irresistible and engaging. And they just want to play with us in different ways all the time. And so we can't do what we did in 2002, which is sort of stand by the fax machine and wait for the insertion orders to come in. We have to create these places where advertisers will want to play with us. And we have found great success with our events, where because we have these wonderful stories that people want to read, and we have this robust service journalism offering, people want to come to our events. And sometimes they pay money to attend, and sometimes clients that climb over each other to just be at our events and pay for us to give us money so that they can be at our events and have our audience there. And we do have down the hall from where I work a custom content division that comes up with, I think, pretty cool ideas for combining the brand equity with an advertiser message in a way that never infringes on our editorial integrity and actually produces fun stuff that I enjoy engaging with. And, you know, the pressure is to continue to come up with these areas where we can dance with our advertisers. That's, you know, we used to dance with them in the sense that we'd have edit here and an ad there. And we will continue to play. It will just happen in a variety of new formats. So, in fact, just this evening, I was hanging out with some of my colleagues, and we're plotting a new venture that we hope will bring in advertising revenue. This speaks to someone earlier mentioned this being a somewhat golden age of experimentation, because the market is driving us to create these new forms of expression for advertiser engagement and for reader and user engagement.
Thanks. Jonathan?
I think Sarah was too modest to give a very good example of that, which is the Toronto Life 50 Most Influential event, which was a few days ago,
yep,
I think.
Yep, last weekend.
Surprising I know that, because I wasn't invited.
51. Yeah. 51. Yeah. No. 51.
Yeah. I'm always 51. Yeah. Yeah. And to me, that's a great example of a way to leverage a brand. I'm guessing it wasn't done on a strictly sort of pro bono affair. I'm guessing there were advertisers there. And but that's an example of leveraging authority, because when Toronto Life says you're influential, that's more important. That, you know, Toronto Sun ran the 50 most influential, you know, it would be like less authoritative. And so there's still enough authority in brands. You know, when I leaf through Toronto Life, there's, you know, they're talking about the best parties and the best restaurants. And I think someone who edits and writes for this probably knows who's who in the city. So if you have an affair like that, I'm probably going to assign it some weight. That, to my mind, is an example of a good way to leverage a brand.
Yeah.
Is that something that would have come to mind 20 or 30 years ago? Maybe that would have been seen as sort of like tacky. There are a lot of things that 20 or 30 years ago people wouldn't have thought of doing that are now at the forefront of their economic plan, because you have to be inventive or you're going to die.
I just want to dispute the premise, because I think there is a premise that there is still gold in them there hills, in the digital hills, if we just figure out how to monetize it or how to manipulate it or how to move the digits around. And I just don't buy it. First of all, I think there's a neurological issue at stake, which I don't want to bore you with. I really urge you to write down her name, Anne Mangan. She's a Norwegian social scientist who
who studies print versus screen reading, just e-reader versus screen, and she studies high school students, not older folks like me who grew up on paper. And what she's finding, along with another researcher in France, Jean-Luc Vollet, is that there's a much higher retention rate from paper than from screen among the high school students. It's not absolutely definitive yet, but it seems to be heading in the direction of definitive research. And I have begun to sound the alarm at my kids' schools and everywhere I can that this is goes beyond our publishing, our petty publishing problems, which, and it is specifically that if in 20 years it turns out that Ann Mangan is right, we're going to have a generation of people reading at, you pick your number, 2-3 grade levels below where they should be reading, just reading competency and retention. And that'll go across the professions too. Lawyers, doctors, architects will be making more mistakes, writing less clear sentences, and so on and so forth. But in the here and now, I do not believe that paper is dead, and I'll give you a couple of examples. The New York Times, a friend of mine, puts this thing out every week. It goes into your Toronto Star, if you want it, on which day?
Sunday.
On Sunday. He says it gives the Star a big boost in circulation, and so does this one, which I love, which is published in Croatia, I think, anyway. It's called Nedeljnik. I can't pronounce it, sorry. Anyway, there we go, and Sunday.
Nice.
And so what my friend Tom Brady tells me is when he goes to the meetings, the marketing meetings at the Times, he's in charge of this thing. He edits it, puts it out. Very good, smart editor. He announces the positive results, because this is very profitable at the Times. And everyone's sort of going like this, I don't really know Tom, because unless it's got a digital angle, nobody at the Times wants to hear about it. It's not the way to get ahead, because they've drunk the Kool-Aid and they think this is the only future, and they don't want to make fools of themselves in front of their bosses by saying, yeah, you know, I saw somebody reading something on paper the other day, and I asked him why. And as your native son Tyler Brulé wrote in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago, there are hundreds of millions, even billions of people who like reading on paper. Last point, and I'm just trying to give you as much information as I can, because I'd like you to look all these things up if you could. Big story came out in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago that basically said that nobody's reading digital advertising. Okay? The research is beginning to reveal that the ad agencies have taken their clients for a terrible ride. Now, I sold millions and millions of dollars of advertising in my career. I hardly make a sales call anymore, but I used to sell a lot of advertising space. We didn't know for sure that general advertising sold anything either. Classified certainly worked, and they work on the web very well. But if it turns out that this has all been oversold, and that there has been this immense waste of money chasing the digital dream, I think there's going to be a piper to be paid. And just to finish this thought, there is now a new study that's come out from the University of Texas, two social science researchers who did a kind of regression analysis, analyzing the top, I think, 100 newspapers in the United States that all rushed to create digital websites on the assumption that everybody was going to be reading on the screen. And these guys came up with the conclusion that if the newspapers had spent all that money on their print editions, there would have been a decline, but it wouldn't have been nearly as dramatic as it's turned out to be. And they wouldn't be in such desperate shape, because as our moderator correctly pointed out, nobody's going to newspaper websites anymore, or magazine websites anymore anyway. They're going to Google and Facebook. It was a complete catastrophic waste of billions of dollars. And the casualties are everywhere. It's not just us, it's also the readers, because the readers are forgetting how to read at any kind of, or some readers are forgetting how to read. But there is still a huge number of people who want to read on paper, and there is evidence that neurologically, I don't know how else to describe it, it's a more effective means of transmission of information and of advertising. And I can tell you, just as my own experience as a freelancer, because I'm a freelance writer and I get treated like shit, like all other freelance writers, that when an editor says to you, well, we don't have space in the paper, or we don't love your piece, can we run it online? And you say, well, do you pay? No. Because they know intuitively, instinctively, that there is lesser value of the thing online. It means less, it costs less, there was less thought put into it than something that was written for a print publication. And I say, the New Yorker, my arch rival, they pay their writers $250 flat for anything on the web, and they pay their print, the people writing for print, still $1, $1.50, $2 a word.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
So
so let's just unpack it. I mean, I think one of the, what you say is interesting about the Norwegian researcher, but I think that research is likely based on a premise that will prove to be false, which is that the technology, the experience of reading digitally will remain static. It will not become more immersive. It will not become better and richer over time. So I suspect that it will. And I would say the same thing about digital advertising. A lot of it is garbage. A lot of it is a waste of space. It's distracting. People don't see it. But I can tell you, as somebody who spends a lot of time on Facebook, advertising through Facebook and Google and doing things with custom audiences and so on and so on, you can see the success of, you can see the impact of the ad right there through the conversion rates. You can track it in real time.
Yeah.
And it's pennies. And if it's not working, then you do something else.
Yeah, but they're doing it on our backs. And the point is, unless there's got to be, I mean, this is my other
it's
argument
true.
Is there has to be government action against Facebook and Google. They're like the Standard Oil of the 21st century. There has to be government action. But our friend Obama is in bed with Bezos at Amazon, and he's got, his administration is shot through with ex-Google people.
Sorry, what government action are you proposing?
Oh, FTC action or antitrust action.
So you think there's yeah.
They need to be broken up.
Oligopolistic conspiracy
it's called
against the advertising?
Monopsony, I think.
Monopsony?
Yeah, that's what you call it. But these are antitrust cases waiting to be litigated. I'm on the board of the Authors Guild, and we took on Google and lost. You know, they're stealing all the content. I promised I wouldn't use that word. They're scanning every book at the University of Michigan library so that they can sell advertising against it. And they're claiming it's fair use and so on and so forth. And it's educational, they don't intend to make money off it, et cetera, et cetera. Just utter nonsense.
But it means that any school child in the world can read 19th century textbooks and any novel you want.
That's terrific, but they should have to pay for it, or we should share the revenue. Should share the revenue or whatever. But it shouldn't be Google and Facebook get all the advertising and produce none of the writing or the music. I mean, it's not just us, the writers that are being killed. It's the musicians, the photographers. It's a great statistic. The American Society of Lyric Writers used to have 10,000 members. It now has 5,000 members. You can't make a living as a songwriter anymore because everything gets stolen on the internet. Just to finish the thing about Obama, if you think Obama's a great reformer, it's just a little timeline. In July 2013, remember, I'm way to the left of Obama. I'm not attacking him from the right, okay? I have to remind people this all the time. July 2013, he opens the new Amazon warehouse in Chattanooga, Tennessee, state of the art. Jobs of the future, even though the jobs are awful and pay lousy and the health insurance benefits are invisible and so on. 2 weeks later, Jeff Bezos or actually the Washington Post announces that Jeff Bezos is buying the Washington Post. You think Obama didn't know about it? And our antitrust division, the Justice Department, absolutely dead in the water. There were more antitrust cases brought under Richard Nixon by far than under Barack Obama.
It sounds like this would be a great story.
Oh, we're
if only we knew someone.
Yeah.
May I respond to that?
Please.
So that got very Alex Jones at the end. The thing that I have a problem with is the idea that Google and Facebook are in any kind of monopolistic or oligopolistic conspiracy to dominate trade. The reason they get ads is because they have a better model, because they know more about the people who are looking at those ads than I do. Good for them. That's capitalism. In terms of print versus digital, I actually think that they can work in concert in the following sense, that 80 or 90% of the people reading Walrus content are now doing it online. And it is absolutely true, as you were saying, that we have trouble monetizing that. There's no question. However, one of the reasons we have a print edition is that the print edition adds editorial legitimacy to the web, because you can put as many stories as you want on the website, whereas a print edition is a zero-sum game. I can put 28,000 words in each edition.
Right.
That means I have to exercise editorial discretion about every single word that appears there. That means I have to employ editorial staff who know how to edit, make sure everything's perfect, the layout, the art, the copy editing. So it raises the product to a particular level that creates a brand index that it's absolutely true that sometimes things go on every website that maybe wouldn't make it into print, but the print product creates a brand standard that then leeches onto the website and people have the same brand association. It means we could have Walrus Talks event, people have the association with the print magazine, we distribute the print magazine at the event. So it's not just about dollars and cents, it's the fact that because you have a print product, it lends an air of authority, and more than an air, it's a reality, to the editorial content on other platforms. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, if you look at Slate or Salon or any of the outlets that are digital only, they have never, despite the fact they've had a lot of good writers, they've never had the same status as Harper's, as New Yorker, as Atlantic, as The Economist, in terms of being one of the most authoritative voices. Because you still, even in 2016, you need the print product as a quality benchmark for all the other platforms.
Well, it's simply because the editing on the web is so bad. I mean, it's just pathetic. Well, there's no copy editing.
Well, okay.
It's just awful stuff gets through on most, maybe not the Walrus website, but on most websites, you can see the difference immediately between something that was in the print magazine, just in general, and something that was published on the web.
I agree with you to
so,
a certain
yeah.
extent, but the standard, it may be so, the standard is like this, but the standard is never like this. It's never like you go to the New Yorker website and you read something that's just completely infantile. No. It is true that sometimes the standard editing...
Wait a minute.
No, but it is true
yeah.
that there's going to be a gap,
okay.
but there's a limit to the gap because there's the same editorial staff who are there. And so editorial colleagues are not going to let something...
No, they have a separate editing staff for the web. It's not the same.
Yeah.
There's not much crossover. But they're not expected to maintain the standards the way
I would dispute the idea that if you went to Atlantic.com or NewYorker.com, you'd find something that was, say, oh my God, this wouldn't even make the Toronto Sun. I just dispute that idea. It's true that there is a difference, but I don't think it's as dire as you present it.
And okay. I think the point that you raised, John, about the status effect that comes with print is true so far as it goes, but I believe that effect is diminishing over time. And I think that it has a lot to do with the audience that you're trying to reach. So the Walrus, I think that's probably more true for the Walrus than it is for some of our magazines because of the target that you guys have. What I worry about, and one of the reasons why we've really pulled back hard from print, is that we've kind of seen that carrying behavior over generations decline. So for a long time in print, or in journalism in general, we said to ourselves, well, we don't need to worry about the fact that young people don't really consume our products because they'll grow into them. Over time, you know, the older you are, you buy a house and you have a family and you get more interested in serious journalism and you're going to have a subscription. And that's true so far as it goes. But today's 20-year-olds are less interested in consuming content that way than 20-year-olds 10 years ago. Today's 40-year-olds are less interested in consuming content that way. And the problem that we've got in print, frankly, is that it's an incredibly expensive way to disseminate content. From production through distribution, it is expensive, it's inflexible, and it's slow. And more what we're hearing from the audiences that we're trying to bring in the front of the funnel, that it wouldn't occur to them to subscribe in print. And you know, when we made our decisions over the past few months to pull back from print, I can tell you every day, you're absolutely right, Rick, that there are a lot of people out there that want to read print. I read handwritten letters from them every morning, about 100 of them. And they're heartbreaking to read, right? Because they care about these brands and they feel like I'm taking it away from them. But these are people in their 70s and 80s who are writing handwritten letters to me. And the reaction, you know, in the ad community and the sources of our revenue is just the opposite. They want to see us get there as quickly as possible.
Well, obviously, we disagree. I mean, I think you're committing slow suicide with your younger readers as well as with your older readers. And I hope you'll read this University of Texas study, which is a real eye-opener. And it doesn't, magazines and newspapers are not perfectly analogous, but it's generally the same with us. And of course, you can read Harper's on the web, you just have to pay, mm-hmm. right? I'm not saying you can't read Harper's on the web. And I was very forward-thinking when the technology became available. I digitized the entire Harper's archive going back to 1850, so you can now search by subject or author, type in journalism, decline, revenue, and everything we've ever published on those subjects will pop up on your screen. But you got to pay for it. We're finding, however, that even though you can read it on the screen, our subscriber studies, our audience surveys are showing that the vast majority of our readers would still prefer to read it on paper. Now, newspapers are different in the sense that you want the news immediately and so on. But again, I go back to the advertising model. And I'm a businessman, believe me. There are two things at work here. One is, if you try to read a news story on a website, you're constantly being interrupted by advertising. It's not adjacent, it's right in between the paragraphs. And if a pop-up ad comes up, I think, like me, or at least I think 90% of readers, they hit the X. They exit out as fast as they can. They don't see the ad. Now they're trying to force us to watch 10 seconds of the ad. I just turn it off. I don't look at it. Whereas an ad that's adjacent to an article, it's right there on the side. It's in your peripheral vision. It's not annoying you. You still get the message, but you're not interrupted during your reading experience. And I go even further and say that in the long term, my colleagues are going to find out that the salvation of all publishing and of newspapers is going to be the so-called freestanding insert, the thing that falls out of your newspaper with coupons to clip or discounts to advertise or whatever. That's what's actually keeping the newspaper business alive right now. Not conventional display advertising. There's still a lot of it, but it's the FSIs that are really keeping us alive, or keeping the newspaper business alive. And the reason it's keeping the newspaper business alive is because, same reason junk mail is still extremely effective. You're still, I'm sure, getting as much junk mail as you ever got 15, 20 years ago, just as many catalogs, is because if somebody drops something on your doorstep or on your landing, you have to pick it up. You have to look at it on the way to the garbage, and you have to make a decision whether you're going to put it in the garbage or you're going to put it over here. A huge number of people, even tech-savvy 23-year-olds, look at the thing and they say, well, maybe I'll put this aside and think about it and respond to it later. This is still a neurological fact of advertising life. And the example I always use in catalogs, because catalog circulation is still immense across the board. Land's End, do you all know the Land's End catalog? About 10 years ago, 12 years ago, they decided they would be digitally correct and beat everybody to the punch. And they canceled, the new CEO canceled their entire fourth quarter catalog mailing. Sales collapsed. collapsed. And of course, the guy was fired. They had to get back in the mail and start mailing millions of catalogs again, because the phenomenon is still, it's still the case that people pick up the magazine. In this case, it's just a catalog with pictures in it of products. And then they go to the internet to order. But they're not ordering while browsing on the internet in great enough numbers to support a business.
Well, there are two things that you said, Rick, that I do agree with. And the first one is that we absolutely have to get to a paid content model on the web. The idea that all content needs to be free and can be monetized through display advertising absolutely isn't going to work. I agree with you on that. And I would agree also that the experience of consuming content on the web is right now lousy in too many places because of exactly that interruptive model that you talked about, trying to put these digital ads in the midst of the content and that sort of thing. I actually think that we're in the early stages of a wholesale change in the nature of advertising, because basically what we're learning is that the distractive stuff doesn't work, not just digitally. I think we're seeing people push back against distractive and interruptive advertising of all kinds. I think that's a big part of the appeal of Netflix. It's a big part of the appeal of digital recorders for television. It's the key part of the problem that faces conventional radio. And in print, one of the big challenges we've had, and one of the big things that has pushed dollars, I think, out of traditional print advertising is, to your point, John, it's not really measurable. It's not measurable to the degree that advertisers demand. The bad news is, as they've shoved their dollars into digital, they've shoved them into forms of advertising that flat out don't work, and that's what the measurements have taught us all. And everybody is grappling with that question, and you know, we talked a little bit about native advertising and integrated advertising and custom content. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of the reason why those businesses are scaling up as quickly as they are. The big question there is, how far can you actually scale it? Can the billions and billions of dollars that sit in traditional advertising today actually get into that new model in a way that actually works? Or is there a hard ceiling that you just can't get beyond?
So I'm going to just jump in here because I'm told that we should take audience questions now. So you've got about 25 minutes. If you could kindly move to the microphone to ask your question, that would be great.
Are we ready to go? My name's Dennis, and I've got a question for you. I noticed two weekends ago there's a big show in town called Come From Away. And the producers, for the first time I've ever seen this happen in the newspaper, took a full-page ad, which looked like a quote ad that you usually see with critics. Wonderful, hilarious, great, I was so moved. Only they were all tweets from people we've never heard of. You mean publicists could have sat there, you know, and made up adjectives and adverbs and sat with a phone book and picked out names. And yet they're passing that off. Or they could have said, hey, here's two free tickets to anybody on the street and write us a review. And I thought this was really another example of how a newspaper is so desperate for revenue that they will go along with this and pass it off as truth, or for somebody who's not paying attention, as, you know, learned commentary by a critic. Any comments?
You should meet some critics. They're not so learned all the time.
I am one.
Right. By the way, I would say that in terms of the critic industry, if you may call it that, you know, I'm old enough to remember when I used to actually watch TV to see what movies, you know, I'd watch Gene Siskel, was that his name?
Ebert and Siskel, yeah.
And that was a big deal. Like, oh, he said I should. Two thumbs up, wow, I'll be there on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And now I go to Rotten Tomatoes, right? Because it's a number. It's, 94%, I'll see that one, 30%, I won't see that one.
What I want to focus on, though, is that the newspaper went along with it and said, yes, we'll do this, we will print this.
Well,
there was a
worse
time when newspapers wouldn't
that's
do that.
That's digital correctness. I mean, you know, that's what I'm talking about. It's just, it's herd-like, lemming-like. I keep saying lemmings because I think they're committing suicide, but I think it's crazy, and it's people got to call it what it is, you know. It's just nonsense.
I'm not sure there was ever a point in the past though where anybody was in the business of fact checking the entertainment ads.
No, but it has gotten worse. It has gotten worse. And the example was in the federal election, when the Post Media newspapers put that wrapper on the front, which was essentially an ad for the Conservatives,
yeah.
Which was, to my mind, done up in a way that you looked at it and it wasn't quite clear whether it was editorial or advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And the Post Media newspapers took a huge knock on that. There's no way they would have run that as their front wrapper on a weekend edition 10 years ago. Yeah. They did it now because they need money.
Well, similarly, there was a story in the Star yesterday about the same show had broken theater records for the Royal Alexandra Theater. You know, it wasn't Canada or Toronto, so that. And there were 8,000 tickets left. The implication better, hey, you better go get your tickets. So it was, they were shilling, actually. There was no, you know, check whether, is this true? Did they, you know, sell this many? How much money did they make? None of the stuff that is the foundation of journalism.
Okay, by the way, just for the record, we don't fact check ads. We've never fact checked ads. So
this was a story, though.
Oh, this was an
editorial story. It ran in the entertainment section.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's inexcusable.
Yeah. Well, but there's more and more of it. Absolutely. You can look forward to more and more of it. That is, if you don't want to pay for real magazines and newspapers. It's up to you, ultimately.
Thanks for your question.
Hi, I'm Burton Woodward. I'm ex-McLean's and now an editorial consultant to some institutional magazines. And Rick, you'd be correct that it's the great way in the door if you need to get in the door in that way, which catalogs, institutional magazines, they do.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, even me, 64 years old, I no longer read magazines in print. I read them on my phone. I don't even bother with an iPad. When we came in here today, I thought, oh yeah, well, it's always great to read magazines. Got to grab those ones over there. They're so bloody expensive that I think we have about $30 worth of magazines sitting on that table, each one. And I just will not pay that. The important thing is to get to the model and get to people being willing to pay for the content. I think we may be at a time where it is time to divorce advertising and content. And Steve, I really wanted to hear some of your views on this. I'm not sure if any of you heard about a company in Holland that managed to get most of their content providers, I see some nods, this is great. And the idea was all the providers, major providers, particularly of your kind of journalism, were online. This is more elite stuff, not breaking news. And the idea is people would pay about 25 cents per article, and the hook is that you could get a refund if you didn't like it.
Interesting.
So all of a sudden, you take away the discomfort with paying by the article. Now, I'm not sure how this, I read about this about a year ago, and I'm not sure how they did. They supposedly had the Times involved and the Washington Post and others, but I haven't heard more. But Steve, you're involved with Texture.
Yep.
And I would like, now Texture, of course, is a fabulous deal, $15 for every magazine in the world. And as a magazine lover, I love it. I often don't have time to look at it. But of course, it's the imitation of the magazine on screen. I would rather actually have an HTML version that gave me access to all of them with everybody, like Rick, being behind a paywall, and this is the only way I could get it, but I need it at a reasonable price. $15 a month, great. I only have one subscription. I do the New York Times, and every year I go back to them and say, I'm about to cancel. What deal can you make for me?
Right.
Because they're way too expensive. Globe and Mail, I think, is around $25 a month, and if I multiply that by the 10 or 15 that I'd like to read, I'm out of control. So, Steve, can you tell us about possible models that might replicate Texture in a more 21st century way?
Well, I'm glad to hear you like Texture. What we have found is that we need to be in multiple digital businesses at the same time. And Texture's been a great service for us. Got a little bit more than 100,000 paid subscribers there. It's a premium digital content service that's gonna turn a little profit this year. It's never going to be, I shouldn't say never, we don't expect it anytime soon to be the kind of product that 1 million or 2 million Canadians are likely to subscribe, because you've got to be a super user. You've got to love magazines, and you've got to be comfortable with the idea of reading magazines more or less in their traditional format digitally. And there's a limited number of people who are interested in that. But the good news for us is that the people who are interested in it are very interested in it. They're willing to pay the price. They're willing to pay double what Netflix costs. And what we can see is they're consuming a ton of magazines.
And not to prolong this, the people behind me, but what do you think? Like, I thought the Holland experiment was fantastic, but I thought they were overpriced.
Yeah.
It's 25, 30 cents Canadian per article. What if you did a nickel?
Yeah.
A nickel for everything, and you could still get a refund.
Well, it's really funny. I think there's all, including some people here tonight, who are looking for exactly that kind of model.
I think that's a crazy idea. Really crazy.
Yeah.
Really, one of the Amazon, and anyway, your friends in Amazon are already doing it. You know, Amazon Singles, and they're trying to bankrupt the magazine. What's left of our cash reserves? They come to you and say, "We'll sell your individual articles, and you get 6% on the dollar." You know, I mean, it's absurd. So we've said no.
Burton, I think the key challenge that we've had, to be honest with you, with the paid model, yes, we've thrown way too much for free out there. We have absolutely trained a generation of people, more than a generation now probably, of people to think that content is free. That was a tactical mistake for the entire industry. But the other thing I think we have to be honest with ourselves about is that as an industry, we still produce too much stuff that's not worth paying for. And we talk an awful lot about the fact that if we're going to make paid content, particularly in the digital space, work, we have to be delivering tangible value to people. People have to be able to look at it and say, this improves my life in some measurable way. And if it's just entertainment, if it's just a distraction, there is a ton of stuff out there to distract you. That's too narrow a benefit to build yourself upon. But we've got a magazine called Money Sense that is wildly popular with its readers. You know, we only ever charged, you know, $18-$19 a year for it. But if it produces a list of top stock picks every year, and we went back and looked at the numbers, 15 years in a row, if you followed Money Sense's stock picks, you would have beaten the market. That is tangible value. That one piece of editorial that we produce every year is worth five times what we're charging for an annual subscription. We've got to get smarter about that stuff and actually put value on the things that have real value and recognize that some of the things that we're just offering as distraction, they're going to be lower value, and our options for monetizing them are going to be
There's a lot of buzz about Money Sense.
Money Sense.
I'm a salesman too. We predicted the crash in 2008, the housing bubble. You can go back and look in HTML. Yeah. Everything's in HTML if you want to read it on the screen. From 2004 on.
Walrus discovered Shad.
You could have saved a lot of money if you'd been reading Harper's in 2007.
With all the jokes, I'll just add that you guys are the ones who are providing the quality that could actually work on a model where you had people pay by the piece.
That's absurd. Really absurd. Can we have another? We've got to have another question.
Yeah, let's keep moving.
I wanted to be a bit rude and ask Jonathan Kay, what do you think capitalism is? Because I always thought that the reason capitalism worked was because market discipline was enforced through competition. And that sounds like the invisible hand, and capitalism without the invisible hand sounds like some sort of Schumpeterian nightmare. And I bring this up because I think that the problem we're discussing today really can't be solved unless we consider in large part the monopoly platform intermediaries that start cannibalizing every single industry in which they operate. You know, the largest hotel company doesn't own any hotels. The largest cab company in the world doesn't own any cabs and doesn't hire any cab drivers. And the disruption that's come to this industry is coming to every other industry. And maybe the media should discuss.
Okay,
great.
I shall now discuss.
Great.
I like the spirited way you're raising your fist at technology.
She's raising her fist at monopoly.
You're on the same
side.
You're on the same side.
Not at technology, at monopoly. That's digital correctness, cachet, as we say in French.
If it weren't for all those motor cars, we wouldn't be turning horses into glue. I think Just Facebook absurd. Is popular. Facebook is not a monopolist. You can go on Twitter, you can go on LinkedIn, there's lots of social media companies out there. Google is also not a monopolist. There are plenty of other search engines and digital media companies out there. It is true that they built a better machine, a better mousetrap, and they're catching a lot of mice. I think it's wrong to look for government intervention. My former colleague, Paul Godfrey, was looking for government intervention on behalf of his industry. I think everybody who is an industry in decline is liable to say there's unfair competition. You know, Jeff Bezos is in cahoots with Obama and they want to bankrupt the industry. I think capitalism always works in the shadow of technology. I wrote a major article on the rise of Uber a year ago, and it's quite true that about a century ago you had a lot of people who made a lot of money raising horses and stabling horses and driving taxis around these very roads using horses, and they were appalled at the rise of motor coaches. And they thought they were unfair, and they thought they were unsafe. And they gave all sorts of speeches against how there should be a law against them. But guess what? The technology wins, and capitalism operates in the shadow of technology. And I have to do that too, because although the Walrus is a charitable foundation, I sell my product into a capitalist world, which means I have to make my product available into the media that people want, which increasingly is digital. The previous fellow who was talking, 64-year-old magazine consumer, even older than me, he gets things on his phone. And if I say, oh, that's hogwash, I'm going to give it to them on print because that's the way my grandfather did it, that's just, I'm going to be out of a job in 6 months. So I think we have to be realistic. And I do think, as I said before, you have to integrate print into an overall strategy that includes digital, that includes events, that includes brand building in all sorts of inventive ways. But you can't just say, oh, let's go back to print because that's the way our parents did
it. I'm not saying that. I think more the difference this time is that they're intermediaries. They don't actually produce anything.
But so then don't use them. I mean, you can go straight to websites that you want. If you don't have to go to Google, you don't have to go.
But people do because, well, then that's because they are the biggest.
Well, okay. I mean, guess what? 15 years ago, Yahoo was bigger than Google. Google built a better mousetrap, and they used Google. 10 years from now, someone will build something better than Google.
But in the interim, before the next paradigm shift to whatever, those companies build up massive economic rents, and it.
Okay, that's capitalism. I don't know.
No, it's monopoly capitalism.
No, it's not monopoly.
It's monopoly capitalism.
Okay, but monopoly is
defined. What do you think? What do you think Google is?
But monopoly. Google actually, under Canadian law, monopoly has to have more than 80% of a market, which Google doesn't.
Well, what do they have in Canada? What's their
market
share?
The point is, there are criminal laws that govern this, and Google has not been found guilty of this, so we can't casually accuse them of.
They don't pay taxes. Criminal laws the interpretation's changed and depends very heavily, especially in the United States, on the administration in charge. Nixon, for instance, was the last person to enforce antitrust, and even he did it haphazardly.
Right.
It's that we have this cultural belief that anyone who's successful is a winner and deserves to succeed,
that's not
what.
It is a kind of Trumpism.
No, it's not.
And Obama
you
parents...
You can't throw Trump at something and say, oh, it's like, it's Trumpism.
No. Winners, they're winners because they're winning.
No, that's not true at all. They're winners because they built a product we want to use.
Oh,
why
goodness.
Is that funny? Look, there are laws against anti-competitive behavior.
What I'm hearing from you, you see, I'm a great critic of free trade because it's fake. I mean, I'm a great critic of NAFTA, and I think that's why we have
Trumpism.
That's why I think we have Trump as
Trumpism.
NAFTA is why we have Trump as president now. But I can make the argument for free trade. I'm a liberal. I can see the argument for free trade. There is an argument. There's a principled and good political argument for free trade, even though I think that the free trade deals that we have are scams. I can't see the argument for a Google monopoly or a Facebook
monopoly
where they produce nothing and they sell advertising against what we produce.
Then don't use it if they produce
nothing. That's not capitalism. That's slavery. It's a kind of slavery.
Right. Well, I guess I think we can't see our chains.
If you look at the life of a typical freelance writer now, writing for Walrus or writing for anybody else, they're turning into wage slaves like we haven't seen since the 19th century. Now, they can get out of it. They can stop writing for websites for free. Sure, they can stop and go work in the information economy. And design websites.
We're running out of time. Let's try to shoehorn in a couple more questions.
Hi, I'm a huge fan of Harper's, so I'll just say my bias right off the bat. But what disappoints me is that we talk about consuming content, that we've suddenly turned any intelligent person who's reading a magazine into a consumer. Whereas a reader is an active person, they're using their imagination, they're actually critically reading the information, and to make everything into consumption of news, consumption of content, I think is a real, that's why I don't read some of those magazines, because I hate that idea of just becoming a consumer and not a creator and not a producer. And then the second thing is that the idea that we have to gear events to advertisers, I think, is a huge way of then becoming almost slaves to advertisers, in that they then decide the type of content that you might have to be able to get their advertising. I know that it's been like that forever, it's been like that for decades, but I think it's becoming, if the content is driven by only advertisers and getting advertisers to the site, that's why television, I think, went down the hill, because no one wanted to watch advertising, and there was more advertising than there was show. And now on the web, it's the same thing. I mean, I shut off any website that sort of just throws all these ads right in between that are just using me as clickbait.
Can I just, two examples I forgot to mention. In France, same crisis as in Canada and the United States. The two publications that are really making money are Le Canard Enchaîné, legendary weekly satirical magazine, 8 pages, no advertising. Go to their website and see what they say. Basically, they say, if you want to read it, go buy it on the newsstand. We don't want you to steal it. The second example, they have 500,000 circulation, very profitable newspaper. Second example I like to cite is 21, which is a big fat quarterly. It's published by my French publisher, so I'm biased, but it is in fact the most profitable magazine in France today. No advertising, it's a quarterly, no advertising, you cannot read it online, okay? Mm-hmm. They promote it online, they have a very sophisticated website, and I'm all for sophisticated web promotion, but it is all paid, and it is impossible to read on the web, and they're making money. So they are wrong.
It's
the
like
digital
Lapham's
future
quarterly
is the only
well,
future,
something,
and right. that you have to integrate this and that. I agree, you can't ignore technology, and that you can't ignore progress, and you can't ignore Google and the World Wide Web. You do have to accommodate yourself to it and use it as a tool. It is a great tool. It has inhuman memory, right? It's the world's greatest Xerox machine, but it also has inhuman memory. But to suggest that this is something that's inevitable, I mean, when I'm talking to my digital, pro-digital colleagues, I feel like I'm talking to communists. You know, to Marxists who believe in, and Hegelians who believe in the inevitability of history.
Those Hegelians.
It's all inevitable. Capitalism will wither away. Paper will wither away. It's absurd. It's just absurd.
So,
I'm sorry to get, you know, but it's, go on. Sorry.
No, Sarah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, the idea that you have to choose between print or digital, from my perspective, seems really crazy. I mean, I like print a lot. We produce a perfect bound, very glossy, good-looking magazine that we think looks nice in people's homes and is a very attractive place for advertisers to be, in large part because print is deeply engaging. And for all the reasons you said, people that spent their attention economy, there's a lot of dedication to reading an article, and we're finding that is still, we can monetize that particular engagement that you were talking about. But the internet, and you know, to reduce it to social media, your phone is where the conversation is happening now. Like, you can't not participate in that. And I also strongly disagree that the digital reading experience is unpleasant. I was feeling very lonely during that part of this conversation, because I love reading a New Yorker article on my phone. I mean, it's the print can get as big as you want. You can scroll. It's very, you know, I've never, I mean, we, you know, pop-up ads are mildly annoying, but, you know, many magazines used to make you flip to the back to find the end of the article because there are all these ads they had to accommodate, and suddenly you're looking from, like, page 42, you had to go to page 82, and they'd have a little picture of the original article, so you could, I mean, it's not like...
The New York Times Magazine is still like that. It's hellish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll tell the editor you said that.
Right.
You used to work for me.
I take reading on my phone over that that experience, but it's not, you know, the other thing about the internet is, of course, we actually use some of that interruption material, that the interruption device, to get people to subscribe to our print publication. So we go fishing for subscribers in a sea of people who are already consuming our content, and they sometimes encounter that through Facebook, Google. Don't really care where they find us. I want them to be engaging with us and reading us, and I can tell you, our writers want their stories to be on social media.
Yeah, but the thing has changed. Believe me, I'm working all the angles. We use Facebook, we use Twitter, we sell a lot of subscriptions over Twitter, and so on and so forth. But the writers don't know what's good for them, and unfortunately, neither do the publishers. I mean, is everybody seeing what's happened to The Guardian newspaper? I mean, I jokingly said they should put Alan Rusbridger's head on a pike on the Tower Bridge for what he's done to journalism. This is the preeminent ideologue of journalism should be free. The Guardian is now losing, I don't know, what, $100 million a year?
Yeah.
$100 million a year? I mean, they're going to run out of money. And they're dumping lots of quality content on, or excuse me, quality writing on the web all the time. I mean, it's still going on. It's this insane suicidal pursuit of, I don't know what it is. It's ideological. That's why I invoke communism. It's become a kind of a crazy ideology. Sorry.
Yeah. Last question.
I'm going to do that really annoying thing where I disguise a biography in a speech as a question. Also, you should know I work for That Man, so if you don't like this, it's his fault.
Okay.
I want to go back to, you were talking about the workforce beforehand.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm 25. I'm brown, in case you hadn't noticed that part. I am a first-generation immigrant. I work in journalism. And I think, you know, some of the stuff that... John was saying on the stage, he said elsewhere on podcasts and on Twitter, and a lot of people have said things like, there's no shortage of young, diverse people coming out of J schools. I can attest to that. I know a lot of them. There's no shortage coming out of student newspapers, which has historically been the other big place where people come from. There's no that's true as well. So my question is, what are you doing to actually hire those people? Because if the answer to this question is, you know, immigrant parents don't want their kids doing this risky thing, or immigrant kids don't want to do this risky thing, then you've thrown up your hands and you're not actually solving the problem. And further to that, if you looked at, you know, the newspapers of this country, all of which I read and all of which are fantastic, and you looked at, say, the national columnist spots, or the people that really get featured by these publications, they're all white. Or for the most part, they're white. So in that environment, should publications not be doing something to actively diversify their workforces? Because it seems to me that every time we have that discussion, and it's being led by, and by the way, if you were to look at a Hazlitt or a BuzzFeed or a Vice, whatever you think about the quality of those publications and the work that they do, they are far more diverse than a lot of old media organizations. The reason for that is that some of them have actually gone out and done that active recruiting. But when that gets raised by people of my generation, it gets dismissed as political correctness or as the sort of the foibles of millennials. So what is media doing to actually right that imbalance?
Want me to start?
Sure.
The problem that you're pointing to is 100% spot on. I think one of the reasons why the three examples that you used as having more diverse workforces stand out is that in the past couple of years, they've been the exception in that they've actually been hiring. One of the things that we struggle with is how to diversify our workforce at a time when we're actually shrinking our workforce. and you know, the incumbency there, and the fact that you know you often need to work through seniority rules and that sort of thing when you're shrinking the overall size of your cost base while simultaneously trying to bring in new talent. I mean, one of the we started up the M School program to try and bring in new young talent, because one of the things I said right off the bat is when you're shrinking like this, the big problem that you've got is the first thing that happens is you slam your front door and you stop bringing new talent in. And that's a huge problem, you know, for the quality and the diversity of your own workforce. The other thing that it does, they go off and they start competitors and often, start eating your lunch. So it's a very deep systemic problem that, you know, I wouldn't pretend for a minute that we've actually solved it. We've taken small steps to try and address it, and I think that we have improved, but we've improved from a very bad state to a moderately less bad state, and the economic reality of the industry kind of create a tide that we're swimming against, and I'm looking for ways to try and solve it, and I haven't come up with them yet.
I'm a little behind because I finally made a woman editor of Harper's Magazine. That was quite radical in the history of Harper's. There's never been a woman editor. She just retired, but I'm not, we can't be diverse enough, but we have such a small staff. It's hard to be diverse. You know, we do the best we can.
So we're wrapping it up, I take it?
Close. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm executive director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. On behalf of the foundation, I want to thank our panel for sharing their thoughts on what a magazine is today and tomorrow. And our thanks to Rick MacArthur for joining us in Toronto to share his insights on how quality printed magazines can survive and thrive in a world obsessed with digital. I'd also like to thank our terrific moderator, Laz Turnbull, for the work he put into leading tonight's very lively and timely discussion. Laz, you dodged the Proust questionnaire. I have a question for you. Oh. Laz, why do magazines have all those little cards that fall on the floor when you open them?
Desperate.
That's not a question.
We can take it up at the cocktail. Please join me in a warm round of applause for our speaker. It's wonderful to see a sold-out crowd tonight, so thank you so much for coming out and supporting.
Did they pay?
Paid? They paid.
That was the last free copy of Harper's you ever get.
They paid, you don't get paid.
For supporting CJF J-Talks. I know your idea of perfect happiness is probably a drink in your hand right now at the cocktail reception, but before we get there, I have a brief CJF commercial. This is our last J-Talk of the season. We have a PAC program coming up in the new year, and we hope you'll join us. So coming up on February 15th, on the heels of Inauguration Day, we tackle politics and democracy in America. We have three of the breakout media stars of the U.S. Election Press Corps, David Fahrenthold, Suzanne Craig, and our Toronto's own Daniel Dale. We'll join CBC's Neil MacDonald for a conversation on the media's role in the U.S. election and the rise of Donald Trump. February 16th, we take that panel to Ottawa for our annual event at the National Arts Centre, moderated by the Globe and Mail's editor-in-chief, David Walmsley. And on February 22nd, we explore the changing face of media with an amazing lineup of speakers. We have Sachi Kuhl, Arti Patel, Hannah Sung, and Desmond Cole, who will speak to their roles in changing media coverage to include more diverse voices. And on March 7th, in the lead up to International Women's Day, we tackle online harassment against women in media in partnership with the Canadian Women's Foundation. We have our Landsberg Award winners, Heather Malik, Janet McFarland, and Catherine Porter, who will speak about the hazards of being a female journalist online and the tools and resources that can help make newsrooms and online communities welcoming places for all. You can have a look at our Twitter feed and Facebook for details on these events. And finally, as Rick mentioned, we have some magazines at the front, so please help yourself to magazines and a CJF tote. And I'd like to now invite you to join us for the cocktail reception and to continue this conversation at the back of the room. Thanks so much.
That's great. Yeah. Hey, to come. I can't believe it.